We're now going to move to our second keynote address. This is The Journey of a Physician CEO. David Schenken will be speaking to us about his experiences.
Thanks. Is this on? I'm going to sit here. Okay, great. So thanks for the opportunity to be here. A lot of friends and former colleagues in the room. And I'd like to keep this interactive because I certainly can't imagine talking for a half an hour, which I think I have, or 40 minutes, is that what I have? 40 minutes about my journey on my own. So it's going to need to be interactive for this to be interesting. And I'd say at the outset, fair game to ask any questions that you'd like along the way. So as I thought about, you know, and I have no slides. So when I thought about comments I'd make, I'd start off with two. I think my journey is probably similar to many of you in this room, has been largely, at least in my perspective, shaped by role models and mentors over the years who played an important role in bringing me to where I am today. And I don't know what the next part of my journey is. And the second is, if you would have asked me when I showed up in 1983 as an intern across town at New England Medical Center at Tufts, that I'd one day be running a company, I would have told you you're out of your mind. Obviously, it was never, ever on the radar screen. It wasn't on the radar screen until actually pretty recently. So it is a journey which is fascinating in the sense, and we all live them, that you just get shaped by, again, for me, role models and mentors. I think I know a lot of people in the room. I won't go through it in a lot of detail, but I'll give you sort of, at least in my perspective, some of the key aspects of that journey and tell you a little bit about what my life is like now compared to my last job. And I don't know how many other CEOs there are in the room. My condolences. And then please, I really want some good, hard questions because that'll make this fun as opposed to boring. So I, like many of you in this room, first of all, like many of you in this room, I've never been a CMO, so I admire the work that you do, and I've never done it. But I was, and still I consider myself a physician as my primary role, as a primarily hematologist. I trained in Boston at Tufts, did my internal medicine at Tufts, then Hem-Onc Fellowship, and then went into a research lab for about 3.5 years, realized that I was okay but not great in the lab, but that there was no question in my mind, and if those of you who trained certainly in a major academic center in the mid to early 80s, thinking about industry at that time was not a possibility. If you even mentioned the word industry, you were asked to leave the program, so it certainly wasn't anything that anybody thought about. And there were no role models, so there actually was only one attending physician at Tufts at the time, a phenomenal man. Some of you may have known him, Frank Talley, who was an infectious disease specialist who went to basically found what became Cubist. Frank unfortunately passed away several years ago, but he was the only one, and everyone thought, okay, he went to the dark side, and he'll be forever gone. So my career path was pretty clear. Academic medicine, research lab, a big clinical practice in malignant hematology, and just try and climb up the academic ladder like all of us tried to do, picking up more and more administrative responsibilities, and eventually was trying to get a cancer center off the ground at Tufts. And I was on the faculty for about 13 years. I had been approached by industry in the right after fellowship by Amgen, because I was doing clinical trials with them and they were just getting started, and I'd probably be pretty well off had I had done that, but again, it wasn't something I ever at all considered. And then I was at Tufts and was very happy, thinking about, for me, the role models that I had in front of me were to be either chairman of medicine, maybe a dean one day, because chairman of medicine, even in the late 90s, began to look like a job that wasn't quite as much fun as it looked like when I was an intern, when chairman of medicine seemed like they controlled everything. Now it seemed like all the money was going to the dean. So that was sort of my long-term objective, that maybe one day I'd become a dean. But again, industry, no interest at all, even though I did a lot of industry-sponsored trials. And for me, it was serendipity. And so I had a friend of a friend asked me as a favor, would I meet somebody at a company called Millennium, which I had never heard of. And I said, yes, I do have a problem with not saying no. And so I said, sure, I'll meet this person. And one thing led to another, and I met two or three very interesting people, and a lot depends on who you meet in the first few visits. And next thing I knew, I ended up in the office one evening with someone many of you may know, Mark Levin, who at the time was CEO of Millennium. And Mark painted a picture, and so this is in November 2000. Mark painted a picture that with all the genomic information we were having, that we'd be able to, quote unquote, personalize all of our cancer medicines. And that was what Millennium was going to be doing. They didn't have any drugs, but they had just bought a company, which had just bought another company, and in there was this proteasome inhibitor that was in phase one clinical trials, and they really didn't have a development team with any hematology experience, except one extraordinary consultant who was there, and so they were looking to build. And I think I was, getting a little bit burnt out from clinical medicine, taking care of young patients who were dying of leukemia and myeloma. I think I was drawn by Mark Levin, who had, as a role model and as a mentor, an unbelievable vision and personality. And I had a sense that academic medicine was just getting harder and harder and harder, and all I was doing was cutting. And industry seemed like they had more money than anybody can imagine, and they were just hiring and being creative. And so 6 weeks later, I was working at Millennium, and that's where I met some of the people in this room, and we went on a wild, crazy ride. I kept my academic appointments so I could still see patients, and I kept the clinic once a week with my own patients for a period of time, and which was very important to me because I wanted to maintain my identity as a physician. And then we obviously developed this drug, launched it. It was one of the most extraordinary experiences in my career. If those of you haven't experienced the launch, it is absolutely unbelievable, and it becomes addictive because you realize the impact you're making on such a bigger population. Millennium began to change a little bit. I wasn't looking for a job. And Mark Levin had always put Genentech out as the kind of company he was trying to build. And so then one day I got a phone call from Genentech saying that they were looking at reorganizing the way they were putting their clinical medicine group together. And was I interested in throwing my name in the hat in a job that would span from first in human to the end of the patent life? They already had four marketed products and obviously working closely with Roche. And our kids were in college, and it was a no-brainer for me to say, sure, I'll throw my name in the hat for that. I won't get it, but that's fine. And to my surprise, I got the job, and we moved out to San Francisco. I moved out in late 2005, early 2006. And Genentech was as good, at least from my perspective. There's other Genentech folks in the room. They can criticize me or challenge that when I stop. But I thought it was as good as Mark had said it was. It really was pretty extraordinary. We had a great group, lots of great drugs. The Roche relationship was complicated but interesting. And in a span of about 4 years, we did multiple drug approvals, taking Herceptin into the adjuvant setting, lots of Avastin clinical trials, which had its ups and downs, lots of new molecules going to the clinic. And for me, it was really the challenge of leading a much larger group than I had ever led before. At Millennium, I had 8 physicians, and at Genentech, at the peak, there were about 60 physicians in the group, let alone the MSLs and medical affairs, et cetera. So it was quite large. But still, my career track was pretty much in medicine, and my next step, I thought, would be to take my boss's job, which was Hal Barron, and maybe become chief medical officer, or maybe even one day his boss's job, which was Sue Hellman, to become all of product development, two extraordinary leaders. And I think one of the game changers for me was that brought me to where I am today is twofold. The first is those of you who have ever met Art Levinson is an extraordinary human. I don't know how else to put it. And as a scientist CEO was a role model that was almost to the point of a cultish figure. Just extraordinary in his ethics, his integrity, his science and patient focus in a company that now was $100 billion in market cap and about 9,000 employees. And I just had never seen anything like that at all. And part of me began to wonder, you know, do I have any chops to think about trying to do something like that on a smaller scale? And then the next pivot moment was there were, at the time when I was there, there were 8 of us who were senior vice presidents, and we were allowed to choose a formal mentor, which I would definitely tell anybody to do, on the executive team, except we couldn't choose Art Levinson, which was fine. And I decided to choose the chief financial officer, an extraordinary young man, 15 years my junior, named David Ebersman, Because Sue Hellman was the other obvious choice, but because I met with Sue every week, it was someone I knew, I didn't want to choose. And David is an extraordinary leader. And my first meeting with David, he said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "I don't know." And so for the first 2 months, we talked about that. And I think we both gravitated towards, you seem to be reasonably smart. You seem to be okay as a leader. Maybe you want to run a company one day. Maybe you want to be on Art's succession plan. And I got really motivated by that concept of either being on Art's succession plan or trying to run a company. And so we systematically, for a little over a year, met every month for 2 hours. I had a lot of homework. And he committed the time to me to work on, if you're going to run a company one day, these are the things you need to get exposed to that you've never been exposed to before running the clinical development group. And so I spent 6 months working with David as an observer, learning how Genentech was doing their long-range financial plan, which at the time, they had about $11 billion a year in revenue, $100 billion market cap, pretty complicated financial picture. I had no clue in the beginning, because I don't have an MBA. I did take a 14-day course at Columbia, so that's my MBA, which was a great course. I would recommend it, actually. And so then David next took me to the commercial group and had me work with Ian Clark, head of commercial, and say, how is commercial thinking about forecasting? How do they think about what that model looks like? And then I spent time with Pat Yang, who was head of manufacturing, and just to see how Pat thought about supply chain and how he thought about factories and tax planning with respect to all of that. And I still thought this was pretty far off in the distance, but I was starting to get really energized about a career move in which I wouldn't focus just on clinical development, although that's still my heart and soul, but have the ability to really span all these different areas and really get back on the part of the learning curve that was very different from where I was at the time. And then the final moment came when Roche decided to buy out the rest of Genentech, which was financially, no question, the right thing for them to do. And then I had to ask myself, so I was 52 at the time, and I had to ask myself, do I want to run a global organization, which meant I'd have a site in New Jersey, in San Francisco, in England, in Germany, and in Basel, which meant probably living 80% of my life on an airplane, or do I want to use this as a stepping off point and try and run a small company? And so I obviously chose the latter. Mark Levin came into my life again. So Mark Levin was now running Third Rock Ventures, and Mark called me and asked me if I was staying with Roche. And I said, I didn't think so. And he said, do you want to run one of our Third Rock companies? We're just getting started. And for me, the criteria was twofold. I said, I'm only willing to look at a company if it's doing something in cancer different than what everybody else is doing. I don't want to work on another VEGF inhibitor or a PI3 kinase inhibitor, no offense, if anybody's working on them. It's still very important. But I wanted to do something different. And it had to be a company where you would tell me that as an investor, if we're successful, you'll let us build the next Genentech. Because I didn't want to go to the company that was going to be flipped in 3 years, which would have been financially fine, but that's not what I was looking for. I was looking this job to be my next gig. And I only looked at one company, and that was Agios. I knew the founders, Craig Thompson, Luke Cantley, and Tack Mack. I knew the science, and I trusted Third Rock. And I would advise you that if you're going to take a job as a CEO of a venture-backed company, the most important diligence is on the investor base and particularly the VCs. Are they in this for the long term or the short term? And there are ways to find that out. And I'm happy to talk to you offline about that. And so I came to Agios. We were about, it had gotten started 6 months earlier. There were about 10 employees when I started interviewing. By the time I showed up, because I stayed at Roche for 3 months, there were about 18 employees. And then at that time, we were basically just trying to find targets and make small molecules and decide where we were going to be one day. And over the past, now close to August will be 6 years, we've obviously grown up. We're now 155 employees. We're a public company. We have a market cap of about $3.5 billion. We have 3 molecules in the clinic, 2 going into pivotal studies this year, and actually 4 molecules in the clinic, sorry, and several more that'll come in over the next couple of years. And it's been an extraordinary ride. And the last thing I'll say, and then we'll use the rest of the time for hopefully ask really hard questions, is I have found this to be the most difficult job I've ever done, no question about it, for 2 reasons. One is that you're constantly, at least for me, from my background, like many of you, constantly on a steep part of the learning curve. Because every time I think I've gotten my handle on Wall Street, then someone tells me about tax planning and tax inversion and where are we going to manufacture our material and what's that going to do to our tax rate. Or they're talking to me about building a quality organization, which I've never built before. Someone else had quality. And how do I think about that? Or manufacturing or supply chain. And so you're constantly having to read and learn whole new fields, which is exciting, but a bit tiring because you're also responsible for the science side, although you hire great people. But at the end of the day, you're responsible for that. The second thing that's by far and away the hardest is, if it's important to you, and it's important to me, I spend most of my time thinking about two things, people and culture. And by far and away, because of human nature, it is the hardest two things to think about and work on, is trying to set up what you want this organization to look like over the long term, and then how do you keep it there? And that is really hard. And then finally, even when I was running, the group I ran at Genentech was still bigger than all of Agios today. But the sense of social responsibility that you have for your employees when you're in this role versus the last role is entirely different. So for me, the most challenging day of the year is in August. We have a family picnic. Everyone brings their families, and I see all the little kids. And you get a sense of the responsibility you have for those families in terms of the decisions you're making and the impact, positively or negatively, you can make on their life. And I find that emotionally draining, that is the most emotionally draining part of the job, because I don't worry about the science. I think you make good decisions and hopefully make good decisions, and the science will either work out one way or another. Same thing on the finance side, et cetera. But it's that sense of responsibility, and it never goes away. So I'm not trying to be a downer here. This is the most fun I've ever had in my career. But I have never feel, even for a moment, that I'm off. I don't take a lot of vacation. I'm going on vacation next week for a week, and I will be on the whole time. Not because I don't trust my team, and I won't be responding to emails, and I won't be calling people, but I'll be thinking about it 24/7. So, but it is definitely the most rewarding thing. And one of my releases, other than family and sports, is I still see patients a little bit, so I go over to Tufts and volunteer twice a month in a busy heme clinic that I used to work in. And that actually, you know, putting on the white coat and touching a patient is a release in a sense now from the pressures, because it is one of the times I sort of forget about work a little bit because I'm just so focused on that patient in front of me. So with that, we got 20 minutes. I'm going to stop. I'm happy to fill in any details, but I'd really love some questions because otherwise I'm going to get bored. Anything is fair game. I may not answer it, but it's fair game to ask it.
So thank you for sharing your very personal perspectives here. You mentioned that one of the pivotal points in your journey was when you decided to have David Eberts as your mentor. And that's a big change for someone in clinical development moving into the finance aspects of your company. Was anything in your DNA or in your family that told you that you could be able to understand the financial aspects, commercial, marketing?
Yes, great question. So I'll probably answer with three aspects. From the family perspective, so my father was a small businessman. He was very against me going into medicine because he thought it was dirty. Touching people is dirty and that I should go into business like him. But I had gravitated towards medicine. But I don't think it was in my DNA for sure. Maybe, I don't know. When I was at Millennium is the one that sent me for this two-week course at Columbia in their executive MBA group, which was extraordinary. It was less about reading spreadsheets, so you did learn that. It was more about leadership and how to think about strategy. And that definitely, I still look at my notes today from the course that I took there. I think I took it in 2002 or 2003. I still pull out those notes. So that was extremely useful. The reason I chose David was one of the most extraordinary things that the executive team at Genentech, and it's what I'm trying to build at Agios, is that when you came in, when I would unblind a phase 3 study, and I'd have to present it to the executive team, there were 8 or 9 members there, and the questions would come like wild. You couldn't really tell from the content of the question what function they represented. So David Ebersman would sometimes, he's a financial person, would ask me some of the hardest statistical questions of anybody on that team. And so I just thought he was extraordinarily bright and talented. And everybody else sort of were ones that I sort of knew a little bit. And so I just took a leap of faith that, and I'd heard that he was just an extraordinary leader. And so I think I gravitated towards picking him for that reason. I don't have in my background, as you can tell from my background, that entrepreneurial itch. I didn't have a job, you know, one of those jobs when I was 10 or, a newspaper route and made money. I never did any of that stuff. I had a pretty cushy upbringing. I taught tennis in the summers because I'm a pretty good tennis player and then became a nerd. And so ever since the end of high school, I just worked in labs in the summer. So I never started a company or had any entrepreneurial itch. Which you may decide whether or not to invest in Agios after this, based on that. For us, we're at an interesting zone now where we actually spent an hour today talking about an interesting term, which is capital allocation. So, you know, I'll go from reading the New England Journal of Medicine to reading Warren Buffett's essays and how to think about allocating capital. Although it's pretty easy because we've kept a very clear mantra. We allocate our capital based on two things, and the Genentech folks in the room will know this. How good is the science, and what's good for patients? And don't spend any money on things that you can't answer those two questions absolutely yes. And then you can worry about other things. But if you can't answer those first two yes, then we're not spending money on it. Good question, though. Need more.
Hi, I'm Jay. I'm the CEO of a small medical device company.
Yeah, my condolences.
The question I have is for that, looking at the culture and people, as a CEO, that role, you're looking often down from, and looking at the people and the family lunch you have in August or whatever. Mm-hmm. But as it relates to Third Rock and looking out towards vendors and collaborators, that culture, how did you figure out and determine that they were interested, if you were successful, to let you build the next Genentech? Because that's a culture that I'm interested in, not just looking down, but looking out.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I was fortunate. So you may or may not know, for those in the room, the Third Rock founders were the people who ran Millennium. So Mark Levin, Bob Tepper, and Kevin Starr. So they were a known quantity to me. I trusted them like family. So that when I locked Kevin, who was the chairman and CEO of Agios as it was getting started, and Mark Levin in a room, I said, look, I have an amazing opportunity to stay at Roche Genentech, a ridiculous stay package to stay, and I'm not going to Agios if you're going to flip this company after the third mouse experiment. And so you need to tell me, as someone I have known for a decade and who I trust, that if we're successful at raising money and making drugs and helping patients, that you're going to let us build this company. Now, so I had that connection. If you don't have that connection, so there were two other VCs on our board, Flagship and Arch, who I didn't know at all. I had one connection to one of them from Flagship, and I met with them as well. For them, I asked the more typical questions. Where does Agios sit in your fund? Because, most of these funds are 10-year funds. Can you show me the track record of companies that you've built? How many companies have been in your portfolio that have gone public, that you've retained your shares and allowed them to go public? Tell me about the other companies in that fund, because as you know, with a 10-year lifespan, they need to deliver back money to their limited partners within that 10-year period, because they can't roll it over. So how many exits do they expect from the other companies? And I had to handicap what the likelihood is any of those companies would actually exit. Because if I'm the only one who's gonna exit, then the pressure on that board is gonna be, you got to sell this company or go public too early. So those are the kind of things. But I was lucky because I had the Third Rock connection and I knew them so well personally.
You mentioned leadership a couple of times, and you've been in a leadership situation in a very large company and then to a startup, essentially. I'd just be interested in your thoughts. Do you think the same qualities are required in both types of organizations, or how would you differentiate between what successful leadership looks like?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the basic tenets are there. What I didn't realize, though people always say it, is that when you're in the current role I'm in now, everybody looks at everything you do. Not only what you say, but what you do. And there's no question, and this was one of Art Levinson's leadership principles, was nothing undermines a leader more than their actions or their words. So you better walk the walk and talk the talk. And any misstep there, even a small one, I think you lose your credibility. So I think a lot of it comes, I think a lot of it's the same. A lot of it comes down to, can you communicate a vision and so that people feel that they know where they're going, no matter where they are in the organization? And can you communicate what's important to that organization? It may be to make money, it may be to make drugs, it may be to help patients, whatever it is, it has to be clear. I think obviously integrity is important, the ability to make decisions, the ability to hire people. I think there is a piece of it where you need to be able to inspire people. I think it is more challenging. There are some amazing introvert leaders, CEOs. I'm not personally an introvert. And so it's more challenging for them. Art Levinson actually, believe it or not, is an introvert. And he hated, as Barb can say, hated getting up in front of the podium. But once you got him up there, he was extraordinary. But he didn't like it. So I think those sort of, whatever your leadership qualities are, you just need to stay true to them. One of the things I brought into Agios from the beginning, as I said in the very beginning, we're going to build a company that's going to be here for a long time. So a lot of it has to do with the type of people we hire and the culture. And so we're going to have a no-asshole rule. I don't care how brilliant you are. If you're a jerk, you're not going to work at Agios. And when I started, there were two leaders there, and I let one of them go because I didn't think that person fit the culture. And over the years, there have been three or four employees that we've let go, not because they missed their goals, but because they violated that rule. If you miss that just once and you tolerate bad behavior, then it undermines your leadership skills. And so it is, you always feel like you're a little bit in the spotlight, but you got to stay humble and you just got to walk the walk. But I think it's pretty similar between big and small. Barb.
Hi, Dan.
Barb can ask hard questions because we work together.
I think my question is around how you think about a pipeline when you are in a small company. So Genentech had probably the best scientific labs, I think, in the world. And yet the number of drugs that actually get to the clinic and then eventually get to the market are rather small. As we all know, the PTRSs are awfully small. So how do you think about a small company? How do you prioritize a discovery effort versus, and I see on your list of bullets, strategic partnerships where, you know, the expectations these days is that you're going to have a strategic partnership that's going to hit a home run, like with the CAR T cells or with a Jim Allison who probably started the rebirth of immuno-oncology. How do you think about diversifying your risk and having enough financial ability to bring forward things that actually meet that final success?
Yeah, it's a great question. The most frightening thing about my decision to go to Agios was it was one of the companies that didn't get started with an asset, right? There was a blank piece of paper. They said, we're going to build a platform in cancer metabolism. Each founder brought in a target, which we promptly killed within about 3 months. They had no chemical assets, but they had targets to work on, but we quickly devalidated those targets. So after about 3 months there, we were sitting there going, okay. So we have a $30 million A round. We have no chemical assets. We're building a team. And so I think a lot of it comes down to two things. One is your board. There's no question. You got to ask your board, are you in this for 3 years or are you in this for a decade? So that was one. Two was, what are we trying to build? And so we knew we needed to build a science shop first, build an R&D group, and then hopefully stumble upon a target. And then the third was, we knew since we were going into a new area of biology that we needed a lot of cash, way more than we could get from the venture world. And that's why we looked for a partner. And our criteria was, is there a partner out there willing to write a big enough check but not turn us into a CRO, not in a bad terms, but just in the sense of we needed to preserve rights because if we're going to be an independent company. And I think there were four companies who bidded for that, and Celgene won that, as you know, and they wrote us a $130 million check when we were 18 employees and zero chemical assets. We had discovered the IDH target but had no chemistry yet. We hadn't even started screening. So that gave us the ability to say, okay, now we got a runway. And we were lucky. There's no question luck is part of it. And so we were able to make drugs, and the first few targets look interesting. the model we built with Celgene was such that we would never have to shut down research as we moved molecules in the clinic. And that's been, I think, the most difficult challenge for most small companies that haven't thought far enough ahead on how to finance the company. Because as soon as they get in the clinic, costs go crazy, they shut down research, then you get this gap. And so for us, that's what the beauty of the Celgene deal was, because the first asset that makes it into the clinic, they have to pay 100% of development. So that we've been growing research every year despite moving molecules into pivotal studies. So I think a lot of it comes down to your board and how much money you're willing to raise. That's one of the reasons we went public early, because the public markets, once they open up, give you access to capital now that's unprecedented today. It may not last. So when we were private, it took us 11 months to raise $80 million. In December, I sat in my office for 3 hours on the phone and raised $250 million. And so if the markets are open as a public company, your access to capital is extraordinarily different, and that allows you to build your pipeline. But you're right, it's the hardest part of our job.
Ibrahim Dagher, I work for a CRO right now. David, I think your story is very fascinating, and I might have a tough question for you, I'm not sure. So it's about learning and learning outside of comfort zone and the diversity of experiences that you accumulated. So for the physician learner, we spent our days learning how to care for patients, and then we cared for patients, and then we took the decisions of moving to the dark side initially, and now I moved to the other dark side, the CRO as well. But with these decisions, there are things that are unknown, even with the best of, informed. So my question to you is about how did you figure out the areas that you could learn, finance and others, and how do you hide your weak spots in this world of wealth of knowledge where you are not on top of your game in every single function?
Great question. I would say the first is don't hide it. And so I'm really transparent. I'll sit with investors and they'll ask me this complicated financial question. I'll go, I don't even know what words you just said. I have no idea what you just talked about. But I've hired a great head of finance who I trust, and I've made him the decision maker, him or her. And so bring that question back now. So I think, I know my limitations, and I know what I'm really good at, and I know what I can learn, and I know what I can't learn. And I'm never going to become a financial wizard. And so I think a lot of it in this role is hiring extraordinary people. I believe firmly in a decision-making model, which I learned at Genentech, in which organizations, groups, committees don't make decisions. Individuals make decisions. So hire great people and empower them to make decisions. Tell them in advance what decisions I'm making, what decisions you're making, and then give them your input and trust them and hold them accountable for their decisions. And so at the leadership team at Agios, that's where I was this morning, every Monday for 4 hours, every topic on the agenda has a presenter, and I delegate the decision maker. Some of the decisions are mine, but many of them are not. And today we had a decision that had to be made. I delegated the decision to somebody else. I gave my input. I don't think she's going to agree with me. That's fine. I delegated the decision. So I would say I try and read as much as I can, but I fall asleep within 5 minutes when I read a financial book. I love reading Warren Buffett. I think it's fascinating. But you just can't become good at everything. And you just got to trust yourself and be humble about hiring people who are smarter than you. So that'll be my advice.
Thank you.
You and then Jim.
Hi, David. My name is Don Dunzu. I'm a search executive at Real Executive. So I have a lot of CMOs that have a burning desire to do something other than just, CMO work or clinical drug development. So as part of kind of providing advice to the networks that aren't available here, what would your advice be to CMOs who want to be CEO? Because not necessarily in most cases clients would want a CMO background person to be a CEO, in which your case, obviously you had a great reputation and connection with Mark and the guys over at Third Rock. And then outside of that, also as a follow-up, not every CMO would be suitable as CEO. So how would you gauge that?
It's a good question. I think a lot comes down to what do you want to do. Obviously, I have a bias that I think scientists and physicians make great CEOs in an organization that's trying to help patients. If you're making something else, then that's different. I think you need to ask yourself the way I asked myself, and if I look at the way I spend my day, you need to be willing and comfortable doing a lot of multitasking and going from one very diverse topic to another. If you are uncomfortable doing that, it's probably not the right role. You know, you can be CEO probably of an enormous organization where you can, you know, stick to one area, but in the early phases, so my day is, I'll come in the morning and I probably go to a science meeting for 2 hours, then I have an investor call for an hour, then I'm meeting with somebody about a manufacturing issue, then the finance group wants to talk about something in tax, then HR's got, of course, an HR problem that I got to deal with, then we're trying to figure out, we're just moving into a new facility, but the fifth floor we haven't taken yet. Do we want to take that fifth floor? What's the financial obligation to that fifth floor? Then the CMO's got a problem on one of our clinical trials, and so we got to talk about that. And then I'm going out for dinner to recruit a candidate, and then there's an investor on the West Coast who wants to talk to me before I go to bed. So if you're comfortable doing all those kind of different things in one day and you get energized by it, then I think it's a phenomenal role. But if you're not, then it's not.
And how would you advise a CMO who doesn't necessarily have a personal connection with a potential hiring person?
I don't think you need it. If you, all the VC firms, if you want to go to a small company, all the VC firms are hungry now because the markets are hot. They're starting company after company. They're hungry for physician scientists who want to make that leap. And you just get connected, call them, cold call them. Third Rock, Arch, Flagship, you know, Versant, there's tons of them. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity out there.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Jim.
Hi, David. So in an earlier panel, we were discussing sometimes the potential for conflict of tension between an officer or CMO and the board in terms of how one might allocate capital, taking a short-term versus a long-term perspective. And obviously, from a company perspective, we're in it trying to build, and that isn't always necessarily the case. And you mentioned your own board, which made me think that obviously you're on the board of the company as
Correct.
Well as leading the company. And I was wondering if you could talk about how you strike that balance between taking a corporate perspective and wearing the board hat when there is potential for maybe some disagreements.
Yeah, it's a good question. There's no black and white answer there. There's a lot of gray there. Yeah. There's no question about it. Fortunately, I have a phenomenal chief medical officer at Agios now, Chris Bowden, who I'd worked with at Genentech. And Chris and I have a very clear line of roles and responsibilities. And so Chris makes all the final decisions on all the clinical plans, clinical strategy, et cetera. When it comes to capital allocation and it comes to the board, are we going to spend money in this program or not? Typically, that'll be a decision that probably will more rest with me than with Chris at the end of the day, because it involves not just the development organization. It involves all the other aspects of the organization. And so that's how I try and create that turf, although there have been times where I've delegated that to Chris as well. But at the end of the day, if the way the rule of thumb I've tried to use at the board level is if the decision affects multiple factions of the company, so the impact on research, development, hiring, space, long-range financial planning, then it's probably a decision I should be making, as opposed to Chris if it's around the clinical strategy and do we believe in this molecule, should we even bring it forward. I don't make the decision on whether or not we have a development candidate, is a molecule ready to go to the clinic. That's the CSO's decision and then Chris's decision. I definitely stay out of that decision. I give them my input. And because I don't want to be influenced by the pressure of the outside world to get a molecule in the clinic that they don't think is ready. And so there, I've clearly delegated that decision-making to them. Once it's in the clinic and we're trying to decide, can we afford another $50 million on this program? What's that impact going to be on research? How are we going to raise money to do that? Then I probably will take that decision. So it's a mix there.
So just to follow up, I was thinking also about the circumstance where with the same set of facts and circumstances in front of you, if you're looking at it from a company perspective versus a perspective of the board, do you find sometimes
I haven't found that to be an issue. I wear a management hat. when I'm on the board. I wear a management hat, less a board hat, because I'm presenting to the board. Remember, the hardest part of this job I didn't mention before is not having a boss. I loved having a boss where I could go every week and get feedback. You don't get feedback in this job. And the board, the feedback you get from your board is you're doing fine or you're fired. And you don't have one-on-one time like that. And so I consider myself management, even though I am a board member.
David, thank you so much. I know we're coming up to lunch. I'm Valerie Bowling with the Conference Forum. Can you just give us some insight into your role and the role of your CMO before you went public and after you went public, how that changed for both of you?
Yeah. So we didn't have a CMO before we went public. I had a great head of clinical development, another person who worked with us at Genentech. And so I sort of functionally, wore that hat, even though I never called myself that. But, you know, if Sam had a question, he would come to me wearing a clinical hat. We tried from the beginning because we knew we were going to go public at some point because we're building for the long term. So even as we were filing our first IND, we set a culture of let's behave like we're a public company. And so that transition has largely been very easy, with one big exception. And that is all of our current phase 1/2 clinical trials are all open label. And as a public company, we can't have the 155 employees know the data. Because if we do, we can do that, but then we have to black everybody out, and that's sort of not fair. And so that's been the challenge, because we've been a very transparent organization from the beginning. But it does, you know, it's uncomfortable in a company meeting, which we have every month. They know that there's new data since the last time we presented at ASH before the next time we present at the next medical meeting. I can't say this is what the data looks like. And we keep a group of individuals who are on a list, and so they can't trade without talking to somebody in finance or they're on a trading plan. So that's probably the biggest challenge, is that the information is not quite as free-flowing as you'd like it to be. But we always have had the mantra when we were private, anything, particularly in the clinical world, anything you're doing in the clinical world, any decision you're making, are you comfortable with that decision, that email you just wrote me, are you comfortable with that being on the front page of the New York Times? If the answer is no, don't write it, don't say it, and don't do it. But if you are, go ahead, and that's the same whether you're private or public.
Okay. David, we want to thank you very much for giving us the keynote address.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for good questions.
Absolutely fantastic. We'll open the doors. Lunch is available. Just take it. Come back in here. And thanks, everyone. And we start at 2:15.